Be seated. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have one case on our 3 o'clock docket, Jerlene Smith versus Carter Blood Care. If the clerk will please announce counsel and the time they've requested. Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the court. Jerlene Smith was an employee of Carter Blood Care. In December of 2009, while she was closing the center one evening with Anthony Alexander, who also worked for Carter Blood Care, he sexually assaulted her as they were leaving. The details were that he prevented her from leaving the room, turned out the light, put his hand inside of her shirt, and put another hand down her pants. She was terrified. She didn't know how to escape. She asked him to let her go. He finally did. She left, went home, and within a few days, made a police report for assault against Mr. Alexander. The very next day after the assault, she went into work, was unable to talk, function, do anything except curl up on the floor sobbing, and it was reported to Human Resources, who then looked into the situation. We filed suit for both sexual harassment and retaliation. The court granted summary judgment on the sexual harassment, not on the retaliation. So we had a jury trial on the retaliation, and they found there was no retaliation. There was not any kind of finding with respect to the sexual harassment. That is what we are addressing today. I know the court's familiar with the standards concerning hostile environment sexual harassment, but just for purposes of addressing each of the issues, when there's a sexual harassment situation, the first question is, was the harassment by a supervisor? And then depending on the answer to that question, there is a little bit of a different analysis. If the answer is no, the harasser was not a supervisor, then the question is, there are a number of elements, but the ones that I think are in dispute are whether Carter Blood Care knew or should have known that he was a harasser, and whether they failed to take prompt remedial action. If he was a supervisor, then the burden shifts to Carter Blood Care to prove that they took reasonable care to prevent and correct the harassment, and in a conjunctive, that Ms. Smith failed to take advantage of opportunities to have it addressed. There has been some recent law with respect to deciding what a supervisor is. What I would throw out there is that if there's any place in which it might be addressed, an issue might be addressed as a matter of law, it's possibly whether or not he was a supervisor. I contend that each of the areas that we're going to address have substantial fact issues that have to be addressed by a jury, substantial fact issues. But I do concede that whether or not someone is a supervisor has been treated as more or less an issue of law. And I don't think there's a court that said this should be determined as a matter of law. But it's been addressed that way, particularly recently by the United States Supreme Court in Vance versus Ball State University. But even then, there are a number of factual issues that arise because of the way that the opinion is set out. The first thing they do is state a number of categories to address whether or not someone is a supervisor, whether you had the power to hire, fire, demote, transfer, or discipline. And I think that the or discipline is what creates a fact issue in this particular case, because Ms. Smith was a phlebotomist 1, Mr. Alexander was a phlebotomist 2. The phlebotomist 2s are treated as the supervisor of that site when the site supervisor is not there. There are no other supervisors at the location above the site supervisor. The hierarchy above the site supervisor are at a different place, a different location. So at that location, the highest level is the site supervisor. At the time of the assault, Mr. Alexander was the de facto site supervisor. Some of the information that comes in is Ms. Smith was subsequently terminated as a result of some interaction with another phlebotomist two, Mr. Alexander's replacement. So we did some discovery as to what a phlebotomist two could or couldn't do, and it turns out that that phlebotomist two had the authority to send her home during when he had an altercation with her at work that he did not approve of. So he sent her home on his own authority. He could do a counseling that goes in her file as a disciplinary record without getting any additional authority, and he could recommend additional discipline. In Vance versus Ball State, the U.S. Supreme Court said that there are, the dissent raised an issue of, look, what do we do if an employer just says, okay, only these three people have the authority to hire, fire, you know, or take ultimate tangible employment actions, and nobody else does, so there aren't any other supervisors. That's a way to sort of artificially, you know, insulate themselves from liability, and the Supreme Court said, well, no, we're going to address that, and they particularly say what we do is if they don't have the power to take formal employment actions via the victim, the harasser necessarily may have had substantial input into those decisions, sort of a cat's paw kind of analysis. And under those circumstances, the employer may be held to have effectively delegated the power to take intangible employment actions to the employees on whose recommendations it relies. And I think that's the situation we have in here, at least a fact question, at the very least a fact issue with respect to whether or not the phlebotomist two position had enough authority where the power to discipline, the power to take action against the employee had been effectively delegated to them. The other aspect that Vance versus Ball State brings up, I think, is where the court explains that, and it also talks about, for example, in the Farragher case. In the Farragher case, they said specifically that the harasser was a supervisor in that case, even though in that case the harasser was another lifeguard, just like the victim was. And they had said that the defendant in Farragher was a supervisor because his recommendations with respect to hiring, firing, discipline, raises, and promotion were, in practice, often followed. That's sort of, again, the cat's paw analysis. So the question remains with to what extent it was delegated and whether that was a de facto delegation of supervisory authority to the phlebotomist two position.
Ms. Hutchison.
Yes, sir.
I was sitting here thinking about what you said in terms of Mr. Alexander having supervisory power over Ms. Smith. And I believe you said that the evidence presented showed that Mr. Ortega, who was the person that replaced Alexander when he had been terminated, but was also a phlebotomist too, did have authority to supervise, take actions, maybe dismiss to go home, those kind of things. What evidence was there that Mr. Alexander had any of those powers?
The evidence that came in with respect to Mr. Ortega's authority was solely in his role as a phlebotomist two. In other words, he had that authority because he was a phlebotomist two, which was the same position that Mr. Alexander had.
I understand that, but I'm talking about what was there any evidence that Mr. Alexander had the same powers as a, both of them are phlebotomist two, I got that. And the argument you're making, I think, is because Mr. Ortega, phlebotomist two, had these powers. Mr. Alexander, phlebotomist two, had those powers. I'm trying to see if there was any bridge of evidence in the summary judgment evidence that put that kind of authority on Mr. Alexander.
Well, Ms. Collins, who was the site supervisor, the actual site supervisor, did testify that when she was not present, that the site supervisor, that the phlebotomist two that was the site supervisor was the de facto supervisor, whether it was Mr. Alexander or Mr. Ortega or whoever it was. Her testimony was that that position carried with it that authority. And With respect to getting past the issue of whether or not he was a supervisor, I think there are substantial fact issues with respect to the knowledge of the employer, whether they knew or should have known that Mr. Alexander was a problem, and whether they failed to take any prompt remedial action. And there are some sort of supervisory issues interwoven with that. Carter Blood Care has policies and procedures that state that anyone who is a supervisor or a manager has a duty to report anything that is either told to them or that they observe that violates their sexual harassment policies. And Ms. Smith testified that she, and Ms. Arriaga, who was a phlebotomist too, as well, and who verified that Ms. Smith had told her about prior sexual harassment, that Mr. Alexander had picked her up, touched her on the behind, and pressed his body against her previously, as well as tried to kiss her. Ms. Arriaga verifies that all of that information came to her and that she did not take action to report it to Human Resources. Ms. Henderson, in her deposition, who was the director of Human Resources, conceded that Ms. Arriaga had the responsibility to do that under their policies and procedures, that she was required to provide that information to Carter Blood Care. Regardless of Ms. Arriaga and Ms. Smith's personal relationship, that has no effect whatsoever on Ms. Arriaga's responsibility to address it and Carter Blood Care's responsibility to address it because of her position. So we've got and Ms. Smith also testified, the summary judgment evidence will show, that she told Ms. Collins, who unquestionably has supervisory authority as the site supervisor, that she had told Ms. Collins about the picking her up and touching her on the rear end and pressing up against her, and that there was no response to that information. I know there were some objections by the defendant to additional evidence that was raised with respect to the open and obvious or pervasiveness of the harassment of Mr. Alexander's conduct. But even if the court didn't consider the portions that were objected to, there were other portions. Ms. Arriaga's written notes that went into the Human Resources investigation and Ms. Henderson's testimony about those notes that state that Ms. Arriaga revealed that Mr. Alexander would say things to her such as, I can't believe your husband lets you out of the house and you sure look good in those jeans. So that evidence also comes in through testimony that was not objected to. And it is our contention that certainly that at least raises a fact issue with respect to whether Carter Blood Care is responsible on what is essentially a negligence basis. And that's also something that's verified by Vance versus Ball State, where the court says that that it's a basically a negligence analysis when analyzed as to whether or not the employer knew or should have known and whether they failed to take prompt remedial action. Now, they're going to say that their prompt remedial action was firing Anthony Alexander, even though they did not conclude one way or the other whether or not he was a harasser. However, there are two aspects to that. One is there was a prior complaint of sexual harassment. They did nothing other than give him a warning. No additional training, no review of the sexual harassment policies, absolutely nothing. Was also the information available about his conduct that was not responded to. The second aspect is that after Ms. Smith complained, they did nothing to prevent she and Mr. Alexander from working together. They didn't work alone, but from working together during the subsequent period of time before he was let go. So it's our contention, Your Honors, that there are substantial fact questions with respect to every issue that's involved in the analysis of the sexual harassment in this case.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm here on behalf of the appellee Carter Blood Care along with attorney Brittany Rowland. As counsel stated, the procedural background and what is in front of the court is the motion for summary judgment issue. It is not the retaliation issue that was tried to a jury. We prevailed and they did not appeal on that. And on this motion for summary judgment issue, we filed objections in the trial court to the Ms. Smith's evidence that she's attempting to argue in front of the court. The trial court sustained those objections, and in their brief, they did not brief any of those evidence objections, so we contend that they waived their error on this point. The issue, if you assume that evidence is before the court,
are you saying that there's no evidence before the court? Are you saying that all of the summary judgment evidence had an objection sustained to it?
The evidence that Smith complained to her coworkers, namely Ms. Arriaga and to Ms. Murray, the evidence that Ms. Arriaga and Ms. Murray were supposedly, that Mr. Alexander made comments to them, we objected to that evidence before the trial judge on grounds of relevancy, and they did not brief that.
Did he sustain it? The judge sustain the objections in writing?
Yes, Your Honor, it's in the same order, which is in the summary judgment order. He states that he sustained those objections, and when I look at the appellant's brief, they did not meaningfully brief those evidence points. But even assuming that evidence is in front of the court, the issue is one of vicarious liability. In other words, when, under the statute, the Texas Labor Code, does an employee's sexual behavior get imputed to the employer? Because we would normally think of somebody's sexual behavior as being private, as being non-work related, and that is the issue. And they did not meet their burden that would allow that imputing as a matter of law. So there's three main issues I want to discuss. First of all, the statutory supervisor issue, which affects what is the burden of proof. The second is the issue of notice. In other words, when does an employer like Carter Blood Care get notice in this case, and who has to get the notice? And third issue is, did Carter Blood Care take prompt remedial action when it's on notice? Those are the three issues I'd like to talk about. So first, the statutory supervisor issue, which again affects the burden of proof. Our position is that Mr. Alexander was not a statutory supervisor. The Vance versus Ball State case decided 3 months ago is just dispositive on that. The Vance case says that to be a supervisor, the person has to have the authority to take a significant employment action, tangible employment action against the person. So in this case, there had to be proof that Alexander had authority to take such a significant employment action against Ms. Smith. There's no evidence of that. Even when Ms. The site supervisor Collins was gone, he had no authority to hire, fire. At most, the stretch of the record would be that he could recommend a corrective action. That's the most there is. A site supervisor has no authority to even do a performance appraisal. So I think Vance versus Ball State is just conclusive on that issue and resolves it as a matter of law. The Vance case specifically said that the supervisor issue can be decided as a matter of law. I'd like to move on to the next issue, which is the one of notice.
I have a question about that. If he's acting as a site, if Mr. Alexander was acting as a site supervisor, you would agree that he has all the authority that a site supervisor has?
I think that's the testimony, although what Ms. Collins said is he basically has my back when I'm not there. And again, the authority that a site supervisor has at most is to recommend a corrective action. That is not enough to get to the level of being a statutory supervisor under the Ball State case.
So the Ball State case doesn't talk about discipline?
Well, it talks about, do you have authority to make a significant employment decision about the employee at issue?
So recommendation of discipline wouldn't be a significant
Correct.
Employment decision?
Yes, Your Honor. That's
your
position? Our position.
Okay.
On the issue of notice, Our position is that the first time there was notice, legal notice, to Carter Blood Care was December 10th of 2009, after all the alleged acts of harassment had occurred. There are at least two on-point federal cases which specifically address this issue, and we briefed them. One of them is the May versus FedEx case decided by the Fifth Circuit 2010. So what happened in the May case, just like in this case, the employer had a well-promulgated sexual harassment policy, letting the employees know, here's the kind of things that you can complain about. It specifically told them who they could complain to, just like Carter Blood Care's policy said, complain to the HR director. In the May case, it was to complain to the managing supervisor. In the May case, the employee who was complaining told her supervisor she felt uncomfortable with the accused. And then nothing was done, and then the employee made the report to the proper person under the policy, the managing supervisor, and action was taken. In that case, summary judgment was entered for the employer, and the Fifth Circuit affirmed that on appeal. In other words, they basically said the date on which the employer knew or should have known was the date when the person designated in the policy received the complaint. It's not the date the employee told somebody without authority under the policy, and in that case, that person was the supervisor of the employee. Another case that, and it's, again, it's a federal 11th Circuit case from 2012, last year, Kramer versus Bojangles Restaurants, which we briefed for the court, same fact situation. The complaining employee went to the supervisor and expressed concern over harassment, and nothing was done. The supervisor was not the one designated in the employer's policy to receive complaints. Next, the employee was told, you know, complain to HR through the hotline. The employee did that. Investigation was done, the accused was fired, and again, summary judgment for the employer affirmed on appeal. Because again, the notice or constructive notice date, as a matter of law, was when the complaining employee complained to the person designated in the employer's well-promulgated policy. We cited similar cases. There's Hockman versus Westward Communications, Fifth Circuit 2004, which is the same type of situation, summary judgment for employer, and similar in Harville versus Westward Communications, Fifth Circuit 2005. In both cases, the accused went to the supervisor, didn't get the relief that they wanted, and then went up the line and went to higher management and got the relief they wanted. And again, in those cases, as a matter of law, the notice date for constructive or actual notice is when the HR, the higher level person, got the notice, not when the supervisor got it. In this case, and I'd like to move on to my last point, which is the prompt remedial action.
I have a question. Wasn't there a prior report against Mr. Alexander?
There was, Your Honor. There was a prior complaint that made its way to the HR director of Carter Blood Care, and that was before Ms. Smith came aboard. And that was a complaint by a lady named Janita Delgadillo, who was pregnant, and she complained that Mr. Alexander had made rude comments about her body. The summary judgment evidence is that Carter Blood Care got that complaint, they investigated, and they just found it inconclusive, that there was evidence going both ways on whether Mr. Alexander did or didn't do it. He denied doing it, and that the action Carter Blood Care took was to give him a written memo which says, here's our sexual harassment policy, abide by it. We were unable to corroborate whether you actually did it, and don't retaliate against anybody who complained. This court, in I believe it's Cox versus Waste Management, addressed the issue of whether the first time an employee has an accusation made against him, does the employer have to take the strongest action that it could and fire them? And this court said no. No, that you just have to take appropriate remedial action. And in the case of a rude comment, which is unproven, putting a memo in the file and talking to the employee about the memo and reminding him about the sexual harassment policy is appropriate remedial action. So moving on to the prompt remedial action issue. In this case, again, when the plaintiff complained, it was on December 10th of 2009. And what did Carter Blood Care do after that? They investigated. They talked to Mr. Alexander, who denied everything. Each of the incidents was basically had no witnesses. They talked to Ms. Arriaga, who was someone that Ms. Smith had initially talked to. They received information from the site supervisor, Ms. Collins. So they took action, and they fired Mr. Alexander. Basically, Ms. Smith came in to Ms. Henderson, the HR director's office, on December 10th. The complaint was extremely vague at that point. She would not give any details. And at that point was asking that Mr. Alexander not be fired and that they continue to work together, though not scheduled alone. And Carter Blood Care did what she asked. She never worked alone with him after that. She and there's no allegation that she was ever sexually touched after that or that he ever made a sexual comment to her. 7 business days after she was in Ms. Henderson's office, Mr. Alexander was out of the workforce, and then he was fired. That is prompt remedial action, especially given what occurred in the interim. In other words, what occurred in the interim, first of all, is that Ms. Smith was not entirely honest or cooperative during the investigation. So in the initial meeting, she would not give any facts other than say an inappropriate incident occurred yesterday. Later that night, after 10 p.m. on December 10th, she faxed in a complaint which is more detailed, which says Mr. Alexander at noon had given her a kiss, that they both went in the break room together and had lunch. They worked together the rest of the day. There's no evidence of a complaint the rest of the day. Then at 6 p.m., when there's several employees there who could have stayed late, it was determined that she basically voluntarily stayed alone with Mr. Alexander and this incident occurred. There's no mention in that written complaint about any of these prior acts which they've alleged in this lawsuit. In other words, Mr. Alexander and the plaintiff worked together for a year and a half, and they're now claiming there were on 5 separate days acts of sex harassment. But prior to December 8th, none of those acts are mentioned in the written complaint that she gave Carter Blood Care. During the investigation, again, it was a he said, she said, because Mr. Alexander's disputing that anything happened. Ms. Henderson calls her up, and she's trying to figure out whether this happened and asks her, did you call the police? And Ms. Smith said no, when in fact she had. In other words, she wasn't honest. She wasn't honest about the fact that she had telephoned Mr. Alexander after the complaint. So I see that my point being, prompt remedial action has to be viewed in terms of the facts of this case where there was an uncooperative and not always honest person complaining. In conclusion, we'd ask that Your Honors affirm the judgment of the court below. My client had an effective, well-promulgated policy. It spelled out what was sexual harassment, who to complain to, the person who would receive the complaint, her cell phone number was well available. It was available on the internet. Her work phone was available to the plaintiff if she wanted to complain. And the first complaint came in December 10th of 09, after all these incidents. And when it came in, it was investigated. Mr. Alexander was fired, and Carter Blood Care should not be vicariously liable for anything that he did. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
First, let me quickly address the objections. There were 2 sets of objections lodged. They were not objections about her complaining to her coworkers. There was 1 set of objections about her saying what she had heard concerning yet another employee who had complained of harassment, Nyla. And it was Ms. Smith's testimony about what others had told her about Nyla being harassed by Mr. Alexander. They objected to that, and the court sustained it. The second set of objections was the evidence about Ms. Murray saying that he harassed her and that it was prevalent in the workplace, and Ms. Arriaga saying that he harassed her and that it was prevalent in the workplace. And the court sustained those. I should have addressed those on appeal, and I did not. So those sets of objections were not addressed in our brief. I will say that with respect to the evidence concerning other employees who said he also harassed me, there was evidence of that that came in that was not objected to. And that's at page 520 in the record where Ms. Henderson is interviewing Ms. Arriaga in the investigation. And at that point, and Ms. Henderson testified in her deposition about what Ms. Arriaga told her. That was part of our summary judgment evidence that was not objected to. So my point was that it's also coming in another form that was not objected to.
Ms. Hutchison, let me get it clear in my mind. The points that counsel was saying were objected to were testimony about actual events of harassment against the other two ladies, but not the balance of the summary judgment evidence that you're relying upon, which would have been the affidavit evidence and testimony and deposition testimony of the employees out at the Carter Blood Center, as well as the testimony of Ms. Smith.
Yes, sir.
So there's adequate summary judgment evidence here, not just that the only things that were objected to were portions of the evidence dealing with statements about other parties' harassment events.
Yes, sir.
Right.
Very, very limited portions that were objected to and that the court sustained. And they had filed a specific document, objections to summary judgment evidence, and the court sustained those in his order. But it was not by any means, by any stretch, even it was just a little tiny portion of it. So, those I did not address on appeal, but there is substantial evidence with respect to the other issues. With respect to who she complained to, I wanted to point out in their policies at page 327 in the court's record, it tells employees, the first policy tells employees, you are encouraged to deal directly with your supervisor regarding your work conditions. So there are at least three different places in their policies that tell them deal with your supervisor. Another thing in their own policies, they tell them if you are being harassed, your first step should be just to deal directly with the harasser and tell him to say no. And frequently that fixes the system. It is a horrible public policy to say that they can designate Tom Smith in Arkansas as the only person to report it to, and if all of the other supervisors know of it and are aware of it, they have no obligation to do anything about it. I can't even imagine that that's really the policy any court would take. So it's a negligent standard as set forth by the U.S. Supreme Court, and so all of the remedial action, including the fact that they took no remedial action concerning what he did to her previously, none at all. And the fact that the action that they took in the investigation in this case was basically designed to quell anybody from ever reporting harassment does not meet the standard in this kind of a case. This is sexual harassment cases are particularly, I believe, not susceptible to summary judgment. They're very fact-intensive. There are a lot of he said, she said. There are a lot of issues concerning, you know, what was done by the company, and was it adequate to address sexual harassment, or was it designed to stop people from ever reporting anything like this in the workplace? And for that reason, we asked the court to allow this to be sent back and addressed by a jury to decide the many factual issues that are involved. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, very much for your arguments and your briefing. They've been very helpful to the court. Your case is submitted, and you are free to go about your business.